Thank you, Sully. And you're listening to Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. A good morning to you. I'm Colleen O'Brien in for Dave. I'm joined by Heather Bosch this morning for an interview with CBS correspondent Cammy McCormick, our Pentagon correspondent for CBS News. We're talking about Afghanistan, now fully under Taliban control, and the last of the U.S. military withdrawing yesterday. Good morning, Cammy. I'm curious what's going through your mind as this 20-year war winds down.
Yeah, a lot of different emotions for pretty much anyone who had anything to do with Afghanistan, whether you're a veteran or an aid worker or a diplomat or a journalist who's covered it for years. It's been a pretty difficult time. I thought I would feel a lot of relief when those last soldiers left, or the last troops left, I should say, because they didn't have any more Allied support on the ground, and they were basically surrounded there at the airport. Mm-hmm. So it was good to see them leave, but you still have very mixed emotions about what we've been watching over the past several weeks.
Hey, Cammy. Heather Bosch here. So good to hear your voice, first of all. I have to ask,
hi, Heather.
Hey, you've been back and forth to Afghanistan. You've made sacrifices there that you've been very upfront about, candid about. Are you talking with other people who've been to Afghanistan, veterans? Do you find some peace in that, or does it kind of raise more questions given how we pulled out of the country at this point?
Yeah, it's kind of been difficult in talking to veterans and others because on one hand, you know, you have a lot of people reaching out to you, and it's good to talk. On the other hand, there are a lot of people who don't want to talk about this. Mm-hmm. I was talking to someone this morning who said he reached out to his brother-in-law, who was a veteran from Afghanistan, and didn't want to talk about this at all. I reached out to someone at Walter Reed yesterday because, remember, there were 18 service members who were wounded in that attack last week, and they're coming into Walter Reed now. And this surgeon wrote me and said it's like the bad old days again. Mm. It's a really bad situation there, and it's very rough on a lot of people.
Wow. Let's get back to the practical questions here. Do we know, because you're a journalist, so I got to ask you, do we know how many Americans are still there? And if so, how do we get them out?
Yet the numbers range from, we heard from Secretary of State Antony Blinken yesterday, the numbers range from about 100 to 200, and that's the number they know about. They've been sending out alerts for many weeks now telling Americans to register with them, to let them know where they are. Some do, some don't. Some want to stay, some still want to get out. That's the 100 to 200 number, we believe, that still want to leave. The important thing to watch from this point on is the airport. The U.S. military was very careful to destroy military equipment like MRAPs and Humvees and helicopters that they were using. Those are inoperable. They can't fly. But they did not destroy some of the other equipment that's designed to keep the airport open, like fire trucks, heavy equipment, things like that. The head of Central Command said yesterday, we need that airport open because the way they're going to get these Americans and others out is through charter flights. They'll have to go through that airport. And so it'll be interesting to see if the Taliban can assume operation of that airport. We've seen them walking around and so forth. But if they know how to run an airport, they are currently in talks with Qatar and Turkey about the management of it.
Wow. I'm also curious if they're able to take those, you know, sure, we say we've destroyed all this equipment, it's inoperable, but are they savvy enough? Do they have the technology to maybe adopt it and use that stuff against others in acts of terror?
Yeah, we'll have to see. I mean, when the military says they've made something inoperable, you can pretty much trust that that's the
okay.
truth. But they've also been saying for 20 years that the Taliban doesn't have an air force. They don't know how to fly. And we have seen some videos over the past few days of Taliban fighters flying these Afghan security force helicopters. Now, one appeared to have crashed. So we don't know how good they are at piloting these things, but one could assume that they may have some brain power. They may have some Afghan pilots who stayed behind. They may get help from elsewhere. So we'll just have to watch this space.
And Cammy, after 20 years of war and so many sacrifices, so many lives lost and individuals maimed, it's hard not to feel a bit empty as we withdraw and face the reality that we lost this war. The Taliban, who we quashed after 9/11, they're back and they're in control. How do you rectify those feelings? How do you look at the positive?
It's not just the Taliban either. It's mm-hmm. it's ISIS, which is, some argue, a much more dangerous group. And the U.S. went in there with the objective of making sure Afghanistan would never be used as a base for a terrorist attack against this country again. And now we're seeing a resurgence of ISIS there, which is certainly no friend of the Taliban. But we'll have to see how that plays out as well. I think there's a lot of mixed emotions that a lot of people have, and I think in the months and even years ahead, we'll look back on this and look at the lessons that were learned. The military is saying basically the same thing, that we'll be looking back at this over the years and reassessing things. Could we have done better? Could we have done things differently? I think there were probably, if nothing else, a lot of lessons to come out of this war.
Wow. Cammie, again, thank you. I know this has been a tough month for you, a tough week, and we so appreciate you, you know, bringing your expertise and sharing candidly some of the things that you've been through.
Thank you.
That is CBS News Pentagon correspondent Cammie McCormick. Time for choke points. Light rail service to Northgate is coming in just a little over a month. Can you believe it? Sound Transit is about to change the names and destinations and designations of its rail. Why can't I read today, Sully? Designations of its rail and bus lines. We hope you're ready for a lot of new numbers, letters, and colors. If you're not, Chris is here to get you ready.
And I've got some links up at mynorthwest.com to go along with this. We've been calling it Link Light Rail since service started, but that name's going away as the service continues to expand, especially with trains that can now go to different destinations once we get EastLink up and running. So when the Northgate line opens in October, on October 2nd, what we have come to know as the North-South link between Angle Lake and Northgate will now become the number one line, and its color will be green.
We will generally no longer use names like Link or Tacoma Link to refer to service lines, but we'll begin using the number one line or the T line. Link will sort of remain the brand for light rail.
Sound Transit CEO Peter Rogoff told the board last week it's all part of a maturing rail network.
The new names and associated colors do follow global best practices that will allow our system to scale in the coming years. This is absolutely necessary when you consider the fact that we're tripling the size of the mileage of the light rail network and doubling the number of stations just in the next 3.5 years.
Rogoff says the new branding also applies to Sounder service and the bus rapid transit as it comes online.
South Sounder and Sounder North are becoming the S and N lines, respectively, and EastLink will launch as the number two line in 2023.
That number two line will have the color blue. So why do all this now when trains to the east side aren't going to start running till 2023? Well, it's all for riders to start getting used to the new numbers and to the new colors so that when more destinations are available, they won't be getting on the wrong trains.
When southbound riders will need to make a decision, as happens on many systems around the country, this is what it means to actually graduate into network status, that you can board the wrong train if you don't pay attention to this, depending on where you're going.
So, for example, once that Bellevue line opens, and say you're catching a ride from Northgate and you want to end up in Bellevue, well, you'd better be on the number two line, or the blue line, as it's called, or you'll end up going to the airport. So this is all kind of part of just getting prepared for the fact that we're going to have trains coming under the stations that are going to different destinations. Rogoff also shared some other news. There are going to be changes to the Orca card coming up, along with a mobile app and web application for it. That's going to allow you to add money in real time. Currently, it could take you up to 24 hours for added funds to actually make it to your account on the card. The South Sounder, or the new S line, will add another daily trip in September and return to pre-pandemic service levels. As for some construction updates, East Link, or what we call the Blue Line, to Bellevue is 92% complete. The Linwood extension of the Green Line, 50% complete. Federal Way, 36% complete. Redmond, 33% complete. So we're really chugging along. And the Tacoma Hilltop expansion, which will be now known as the T Line, is set to open in 2022.
Yeah, but what color is the T-line?
Let me check the T-line. I'll get that for
Tacoma?
You in a second.
It's
up at mynorthwest.com. Let me just check my story and
Tacoma
click
with
my own link. I don't have them set to memory yet.
I have it. I feel like Tacoma is green.
No, green is the number one line.
Oh, okay.
So let's see. T is going to be orange. It's going to be an orange color with the T line. Eventually, there's going to be the 3 line, the 4 line, you know, with things going to Ballard and whatnot. So eventually, it's a maturing system, and it just needs to be more than just saying, hey, I'm going to catch light rail. Well, okay, where are you going? Because now it's not just going to go north and south anymore. It's going to go east and west as well. So this is what happens when you start becoming a big boy or girl transit system.
I know. Pretty soon they're going to be selling our transit system maps at tourist attractions, you know, like they do the Paris Metro line. People want to frame that and put that on their wall. I kid, of course. I passed through. I took had my girls with me, and I took the HOV exit there at 44th and Linwood. And boy, what a grown-up light rail station that's going to be in Linwood.
Oh, yeah.
I saw it's not just the rail line anymore. They actually have, like, the stairs and elevator part built up and,
yep,
and ready to finish. And I'm getting excited. I know this has taken years, and as a station, we give light rail a lot of grief.
Yeah.
Because they're using our money, but this is exciting to see. It does feel quite grown up.
And what I've always said about light rail is it really probably won't make a difference to the average commuter, mm-hmm, as a choice until it went somewhere. I mean, if you're just going from Seattle to Seattle, it's like it doesn't, yeah, take anybody off the road. And granted, light rail isn't really designed to take people off. It's designed to give people choices. But once you get to places where people commute from, like Linwood, Federal Way,
Everett,
Bellevue, it'll start bringing some people who might be in single occupancy vehicle cars now. But until it goes somewhere, it's not going to have an impact. And it's getting there. I mean, Northgate here in a month. That'll be great. And then, you know, we're just a couple of years away from it going to Bellevue and to Linwood. And yeah, so I think then it'll start making a difference at that point, unless, of course, we're all in autonomous cars and no one's on the train anymore. But we'll just hopefully.
Well, the pandemic has permanently kept us home.
Let's hope it doesn't last that long.
Yeah.
But that
Linwood's
point is well taken.
Linwood's supposed to open when?
Linwood, 24.
Okay, 2024. And then plans to go to Everett, right? That's not till
2031. 41. They moved that back. Yeah.
Okay,
sorry.
I hope my grandchildren appreciate it.
It'll get to Mariner High School in that South Everett area before that, but as last time I checked, I believe it's 2041 to get it to Everett proper there at the normal Sounder station there, or the rail station in Everett. So, yeah, we've got a long way to go through Everett. And then,
deep
of course,
breath.
Ballard and whatever. Yeah. We might not ever be able to write it from our homes.
Okay.
Before we die. Consider where we live.
Let's keep it back on the positive. Northgate opens next month.
Yay! Yeah, exactly.
This morning I was reading a tweet from a doctor. Said, nothing makes me anxious as having a C-section tray and newborn code chart in my ICU. Says, sadly, I've seen more COVID in pregnancy in this wave than ever before. And women are dying. There are fresh warnings here, too, from healthcare workers in our state as hospitalizations from COVID and other ailments continue to rise. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott, as always, keeping her eyes on this developing story. Hannah, what's happening in our state?
Nothing good as far as COVID goes, Colleen. Good morning. More than 400 new hospitalizations were reported over the weekend. This is as the state reports. Just the continuing surge of the Delta variant really taking a toll on our healthcare systems, our hospitals, and our community as a whole. There were more than 8,800 new cases reported over the weekend. Again, more than 400 hospitalizations and 27 new deaths. Put another way, the healthcare systems report more than 16% of the hospital beds right now in our state are being taken up by COVID patients, and more than 33% of ICU beds are currently being taken up by COVID patients. That is happening all over the state. There is some big concern. We heard from the state Hospital Association yesterday, and they warned about things. They said they feel like people aren't taking it as seriously as they should.
I was going to say, Hannah, you know, all these dire warnings. I was struck yesterday when I had to make a quick stop to pick up some shoes at the Alderwood Mall, and it just looked like life is normal. I was so used to empty malls because, mm-hmm, of this pandemic. So many people were staying away, and it was so full, so packed. Fortunately, most people wearing their masks indoors as they should, but it really did seem like life is going on as normal now. We've all decided what risks we're willing to take. All the while, here I'm covering the news in the morning. In the back of my head, I'm thinking, holy cow, the ICUs are filled up. Pregnant women are dying because they're not getting vaccinated to protect,
right,
themselves and their children. Like, it's just a strange sense of things aren't going well, and yet life is moving on.
And it's. I think I've talked to some people who think that there's maybe some mixed signals. You know, again, back just a few months ago, we had the governor and everyone else coming out and saying, welcome back. It's time to get back out there. And
President Biden, he declared,
right,
freedom from the virus on,
right,
July 4th.
I know.
Right? Yeah.
Reminds,
like,
you
of what
mission
is?
Accomplished a little bit,
yeah.
I think. But that's not the case. It's, you know, I don't think anybody necessarily saw Delta coming as it is right now, but it's bad. And look, we heard from the hospital people yesterday who spoke that we could end up like Oregon if people don't pay attention and take this seriously. And what that meant was refrigerated trucks to deal with the bodies. And
yeah,
that's
that
not something we want here.
Early in the pandemic in New York and Spain and, you know, Italy. And we were all horrified to think, you know, of rolling morgues in the streets of New York City. And we're back.
And this is the healthcare leaders in our state yesterday said this is such a big problem. And especially with big events like the Puyallup Fair.
Do we think it's a bad idea for events like the Puyallup Fair to go on considering the current situation?
And I am very, very concerned about the stress that that will put on our emergency room and the stress it will put on our systems. Our state doesn't have the capacity to manage a mass event at this point.
And so we've got the Puyallup Fair going on, Evergreen State Fair. I know that the that's in the Snohomish County area. They actually put some rules in place over the weekend where they had shut it down a little bit earlier. They're not having, they want fewer people in there, right? So they don't want to have capacity quite where it was. The best defense for all of this, as usual.
Vaccinations are still the key. The 90 to 95% of the patients that we're seeing in hospitals who get very ill are unvaccinated. And so people, you know, it's not too late to get a vaccine. Go today, get a vaccine, get the series started.
But here's the problem.
In addition to a huge...
That's not the problem.
JMZ, if you want to mandate the vaccine, come on down here and give it yourself.
State employees and those of us in the medical field should have the freedom to choose to be vaccinated or not. We believe it's our right as American citizens to choose.
So that's from this weekend's anti-vaccine mandate rally that was held down in Olympia. There's been one every weekend down in Olympia and then in other parts of the state as well, where hundreds of people are showing up, speaking out against that. I will say, while a lot of them are healthcare workers, they don't say to me when I was at the one 2 weeks ago, it's not that they're against the vaccine, it's that they're against not having the choice. But still, that message is out there. I get it.
I know. And listen, I think we've shamed people enough. Shame doesn't work, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I could sit here and I could go, oh, I'm so frustrated with these people who won't give it. That does not work. In fact, it just pushes them further away from doing what needs to be done in a public health crisis. And I recently helped a family member who I finally heard was actually afraid of this vaccine, could acknowledge that it was an irrational fear. And just the compassion of saying, let me hold your hand and help you through this moment to get vaccinated, to cross that bridge and say, I get your fear. I understand you. Let me help you. That's what helped that family member finally get vaccinated a year and a half into this pandemic. So I don't know if it can work with every single person screaming outside the governor's mansion, but I sure hope that a little bit more compassion and a lot less shame will help turn people towards the vaccine.
And absolutely. And I'm going to tell you, from talking to some of these people at those rallies, those anti-mandate rallies, there are some people who have some very strong
real
beliefs,
fears.
Real fears that are
real.
Very, very real. Yes. And
it doesn't matter if they're
irrational.
Their
kids are going to die. Yeah. They think their kids are going to die if they give them the vaccine. So,
if you've ever had a phobia, right? I'm arachnophobic. I've been through therapy before.
You and I both.
I recognize that the fear is irrational, but it is still real, and I cannot help it. And the same for a subsection of the anti-vaxxers or the anti-mandates. I believe there are some out there who have a real fear, who just need a helping hand and a heart to tell them it's going to be okay.
And I think,
listen, this is very kumbaya, woo-woo, but I'm telling you, shame is not going to work. We've tried it. They're shamed up and down the internet, and it's not working. So we've got to find another way to get the community protected.
And that's why you'll hear every time the governor speaks, he'll encourage every one of us to talk to those in our circle, our family members, our loved ones, our friends, whomever it is, and encourage them and do exactly what you're saying, right? Help them get to where they need to be to get that vaccine and just kind of look at the numbers, right? It's been okay. It's been okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Hannah, anything else you need to tell us about this virus in our state right now?
Just again, really to stress to people that it is not, we are not back to normal. You've got to be very careful. Social distancing. School's about to start. And they've got the, you know, 3-foot rule going on in most of our schools. Everybody needs to remember to mask up, try to keep your social distancing. And they're really, the hospital workers, they're saying really avoid these big gatherings. Be careful what you do on Labor Day because they don't have the capacity and they also don't have the staff.
I have to admit, I am getting very nervous about sending my daughter to school.
But I am too.
We're going to do it. Yeah. I saw how healthy it was for her to return to the hybrid learning this last year. It was like my daughter woke up again, right? I had this little depressed being around my house from lack of social interaction and just the stress of two working parents and her trying to school and us trying to keep our jobs. And then one day back at school, and it's like she was floating as I picked her up from school. So,
so important when they're that young.
My
daughter got her class schedule yesterday. She's very excited. Her elective is Introduction to Law. I'm very excited. She was very excited, and it's her senior year, so we are gonna give it a try. We'll see how it goes.
Fierce, just like her mama. Thank you, Hannah. It's time for the Daily Dose of Kindness now, sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. A 93-year-old woman from Kansas is obsessed with a dance song she describes as fun and joyous, and now her neighbors are joining in. CBS's Steve Hartman has the story.
Although her dancing days are done, Phyllis Brinkerhoff of Prairie Village, Kansas, says she's not too old to appreciate a sick beat. In fact, Mrs. B, as she's known in the neighborhood, is obsessed with one dance song in particular.
It's just a fun, joyous song.
You put your right arm in.
The Hokey Pokey. And you know how when you love a song, you want your friends to love it too? Well, that's why Mrs. B gave her neighbor, Melanie Mendries, a Hokey Pokey CD and started talking about the song constantly.
I couldn't see her name pop up on my phone, and I just thought, oh, it's the Hokey Pokey.
Hi, this is Phyllis.
Mrs. B left dozens of messages.
I really do need to talk to you.
Urgently pleading her case.
CD I gave you, are you hooked on it yet?
And I just would always say, not quite yet.
Melanie's reluctance baffled Mrs. B.
You know, most people don't care really at all for the Hokey Pokey.
Really?
Really.
I find that very amazing.
Do you?
Still, she knew her crusade was all but lost.
Then one day, Mrs. B happened to mention that her birthday was coming up, her 93rd. And when Melanie heard that, she decided to embrace what she'd been resisting. Or to put it in Hokey Pokey parlance, she put her whole self in.
We made copies of the invitation, we rolled them in little scrolls, and we wrapped ribbons around them and traipsed up and down the street.
You put your whole self in, you put your whole self out.
It was a Hokey Pokey flash mob.
Shake it all about.
The smile on her face was so big. It doesn't take that much to make someone's day. And I think we could all do a little more of it.
Because that's what it's all about.
Be honest. Be honest. You were singing along and or dancing in your seat.
Yeah, I was.
You can't help it. It's such a catchy
tune. Or at least twirled a toe here and there, maybe.
Sure. Takes us back to childhood. It is 7:47. Time to welcome G. Scott from the G and Ursula Show, 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio. Good morning, G.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. What's happening?
What's your reaction to the news of Cam Newton being let go by the New England Patriots?
Not surprised at all.
Ooh.
I put a tweet out there in August, mid-August, I think August 19th, and I said, and I believe that Mac Jones, who was the first-round pick by the New England Patriots, I predicted he would be the starter week one.
Wow.
And I made that prediction for two reasons. Number one, the Patriots see something in Mac Jones for them to draft a quarterback in the first round. That's number one. And by the way, Mac Jones is pretty good. I got to see him in the national championship game against my son's team down there in Miami. Number two, Cam Newton does not want to take the vaccine. Now, there's some people who are like, oh, I can't believe they would make that decision. Let me tell you something. The quarterback is the face of the team, period. And so what Bill Belichick, I guarantee you, did not want to do is to go in with that distraction.
Wow.
There's a difference in testing. The NFLPA, the NFL Players Association, they sent out a deal actually yesterday cementing what the testing protocol is going to be this season. And it's simple. If you are vaccinated, it was going to be every 2 weeks you would get a test, a COVID test. Now it's once a week you get a COVID test. If you are unvaccinated, you will get tested every single day. Now,
wow.
Bill Belichick is the man. Like, that's the guy, if you could arguably say one of the greatest coaches of all time. This is someone who was the coach that kind of, if you will, helped build Tom Brady. Do you really think Bill Belichick is about to deal with a quarterback that's having to get tested every single day and then show up one day? Oh, I'm sorry, Bill, I can't play. Do you guys really think Bill's going to deal with that? No, he's not. Now, I have another messy scenario, and I can share with you guys.
I love messy.
Right. Here's my messy scenario. This is me watching YouTube. Anyways, Nick Caserio was the acting general manager for the New England Patriots before. Now Nick Caserio is the general manager of the Houston Texans right now. The Houston Texans have a quarterback situation going on too with Deshaun Watson. So you got to wonder, could there be possibly a deal later on in the future? Because they are looking to kind of trade or get rid of Deshaun Watson. So that's kind of my messy deal dilemma. But don't read into that. Read into this. Read into this, and this is the truth. Cam Newton not getting the vaccine, I believe, contributed to this because they can't risk this week in and week out not knowing if they're going to have the quarterback.
I know Cam Newton's a character, but boy, to give up a position with the New England Patriots because of a vaccine, that seems drastic.
Yeah.
Unless you know there's a golden parachute for you on another team.
Yeah, it does. Well, I mean, some people believe in their stance. And by the way, that is fine. I'm not even getting into whether or not you should get it or not. And I think we shouldn't. But you got to think that these employers have that decision to make. Now, of course, I don't think New England's going to come out and say the reason why we released Cam Newton is because he didn't get the vaccine. But you're able to put 2 + 2 and make it equal 4 on this situation. And this is one of those situations. Like, they won't know every single day if that's going to be the quarterback. And then if Cam does test positive, then you got to do contact tracing. And then that might involve other players on the team. Mm-hmm. It's just a hot mess when that happens. And so, again, we talk about the vaccine. All 50 governors in the United States, guess what they all have in common, Colleen?
They're vaccinated.
Vaccinated.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How powerful would it be, though, if the Patriots did actually say that was the reason? We got to get to our next topic, though, because we want to talk about Dave's commentary, which is about China putting restrictions on how much time kids can spend playing online video games in a given week. And the limit is 3 hours. Thoughts?
Mm-hmm. First of all, glad I live in the United States of America. that's my first thought, right? Like, yeah. Everybody always talks trash about this place. Oh, the United States is so terrible. Then go move over there then. No, I'm glad I live there. That's number one. Number two, let's just kind of keep it how it goes here. I don't know why parents or anybody has such disdain towards video games. Like, I know what it is. Sometimes people don't like to see other people happy. So sometimes when parents walk in the door and they've had a tough day at work and little Johnny and little Sarah might be playing video games and are having a good time, that parent's like, turn those video games off. Go do something productive. Oh, you mad because you had a bad day at work and you mad at me? I'm just having a good time. Some people, parents, don't like for children to have a good time. You know what kids could be doing instead of playing video games?
Building a fort.
or causing more trouble than that, right?
That's,
like,
yes,
I just never understand how some people. Now, is there a such thing as playing too much video games? Sure.
Yes.
So I think that there's a lot of positives, and I think over in China it's kind of par for the course. You're not surprised that the government comes in and tells those families. I mean, this is the same place that used to tell families how many kids they can have and all that. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, I am blessed to live in America.
America the free.
The
yes.
Free.
I was just talking to my daughter who's 8 about, you know, that she's like, why can't I play Minecraft? And I said, because there's value in being bored. That's what we're missing today in childhood is the value of being bored. I know we don't have a lot of time to explain this. Maybe we can continue this tomorrow. But she was really trying. Her wheels were turning, going, interesting. I said, because when you're bored, you figure out something to do. And that's an important value later in life.
Oh, Colleen. James Redishevitz, if you're listening, put this on the list. We are talking about this tomorrow. Value and being bored, I'd argue that.
It's 8:15 on Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. I'm Colleen O'Brien. And on Tuesday mornings, we go live to our nation's capital and Pulitzer Prize winning reporter David Fahrenthold at the Washington Post. Freshly vacationed. David, how are you feeling?
I'm great. Thank you. Thanks for having me on. I was up in the Northwest, not quite as far out as y'all, but I was up in Montana for a couple of weeks.
Oh, love big sky country. So you went on vacation a couple of weeks ago, the Taliban was just starting its march towards Kabul. So how did you stay up to date on the Taliban or what's happening in your world now?
Well, we tried to stay on top of it as much as we could. It was stunning, I think, to everybody, including the Pentagon and people in the former Afghan government, that this happened this fast. But yeah, it was a case of where I went on vacation, the world looked one way. When I came back, it was, you know, at least that part of it was radically different.
And what has been the reaction in Congress and in the White House to how this chaotic evacuation played out?
Well, I think the Biden administration, whether you can blame them or not, was caught flat-footed. They, from what we've reported, believe they had weeks, months, even years, perhaps, before the Taliban got close to Kabul. They thought they had, they'd spent billions of dollars building up this huge Afghan military and that it would, it would fight. I don't think what they or the people in the Afghan government had planned on was the fact that basically nobody would fight. I mean, this was not a fight for Kabul or really any of the provincial capitals. It was a walkover. The Afghan forces just disappeared and the Taliban walked in. And so instead of it taking weeks or years, it took days.
I don't know if you've heard or seen this clip floating around this morning, but someone from C-SPAN dug it up, and I saw it on Twitter. It was a then-Senator Joe Biden on October of 2001 speaking to the Council on Foreign Relations. Here, we'll listen.
On September 11th, the world changed. It changed utterly, as William Butler Yeats said in a different context. But it did not change our way of life. It will not change our way of life. I truly believe you'll be funding young scholars here at the Council 20 years from now when they mark September 11th as the day that began the end of the ability of international, transnational terrorist groups to be able to operate with impunity, not the end of America's way of life. I believe it's the beginning of the end for that evil, not the beginning of the end of our way of life.
Kind of hurts to hear that, right? 20 years later and none of that came to fruition. But what could he have done, right? He was a senator, even as vice president. Was there anything?
Well, I mean, one thing you could have done, and this, at least as a senator, is opposed to the Iraq war. I mean, it was hard to know how that would play out. But I think it's impossible to look at the U.S. defeat in Afghanistan without understanding that for a long time that was the back burner war. We were in two wars at once, and Afghanistan was not the one we were focused on. The war of choice in Iraq, which I believe Joe Biden supported, was the thing that distracted everyone's attention, took money, manpower, brain power away from Afghanistan. Reading analyses of the war now, it's all easier to see in hindsight. You see people saying, look, if we had in 2002, 2003, in the very earliest days of the war, accepted the Taliban surrender, found a way to really rebuild Afghanistan, put a ton of people and money into that, then maybe it would look different now. But the failures in those early days let the Taliban get a foothold that they never, they just gradually increased until now they've got the whole country.
Right. I've watched the strategy of, Republicans as this played out for President Biden. They even posted a picture this morning of him taking a glance at his watch as the fallen service members in that suicide bombing were taken off of their plane. So this is clearly a gold mine for Republicans politically. How is that going to play out in Congress as far as investigations and I suppose trying to block him or Kamala Harris from another term?
It is really interesting because the policy of getting out of Afghanistan obviously was very popular in America. Trump supported it. Trump ran on it. The timeline of Biden pulling out troops was sort of set in motion by a deal that Trump made with the Taliban in February of 2020. So you know, there was support among Republican voters and the last Republican president for getting out. And so the criticism then becomes not that Trump, that Biden got out, but that he got out the wrong way. You know, that he, right. he moved too fast. He pulled troops back too fast to put people in harm's way when they shouldn't have been. So I think there will be a lot of criticism, but it's interesting to see, you know, how much the Republican viewpoint has changed. Would I think even 10 years ago, they would have said, you know, we need more people in Afghanistan, not less. You know, we need to fight the terrorists there so we don't have to fight them here. Now they're saying, well, okay, it was the right thing to do to get out of Afghanistan, but, you know, you did it the wrong way.
Yeah, that was interesting to watch during the Trump administration, because I do remember Republicans saying, you know, more troops, we need to get, you know, hold of this country. And President Trump says, no, we need to leave. We need to get out of there. I promise, you know, I alone am going to end the war in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And they all fell in line with him. So, yeah, the flipping and flopping on both sides, right? This isn't just a Republican thing. It's a Democrat thing, too. The flipping and flopping, we all get caught in between.
That's right. I mean, if you think about, you know, the last two presidents before Biden, Obama and Trump, both said they would end the war in Afghanistan, and neither one did. Trump said he would get out, and he made the deal to get out, but didn't actually have to deal with the difficulties of removing everybody. So, yeah, I mean, I think Biden, you know, did the thing that other people wanted to do but couldn't bring themselves to, you know. But now the reason that those two past presidents didn't really want to do this is because it would be messy and horrible. And now Biden has, you know, in doing the thing that they wouldn't, he's now accepting the consequences that they wouldn't die. They wouldn't either.
Sure. He's been in politics a while. I think he can handle the heat. You know, you made a name for yourself covering former President Trump. What is our former president up to these days?
Well, he is a diminished figure. I mean, still a very powerful figure in Republican politics, but he's lost his platforms on Twitter and Facebook. He has influence in the, you know, among the party faithful. And it's interesting to see how he's using it. He mostly seems to be using it to push for audits of the 2020 election, you know, designed to prove that he actually won. And he's had attention in the last few months on the January 6th rioters, you know, trying to, you know, sort of cast them as heroes, and especially Ashley Babbitt, the woman who was shot during that and died during that attack, you know, to cast her as kind of a martyr. So, you know, Trump, I think there are many in the Republican Party who don't see that current Trump agenda, you know, the focus on 2020 and on January 6th as a path to anything. And so I think you're starting to see people hoping that Trump will sort of be eased off the scene. That's hard, because the party faithful like Trump better than they like anybody. You know, we've been talking about easing Trump off the scene since 2015, when Jeb Bush was going to do it. So, you know, nobody has actually done that yet. But the fact that Trump has less of a microphone, I think, makes Republicans more hopeful that they can focus on issues other than him and win in 2022.
More stable, for sure. I laughed because when was the last time either celebrity Donald Trump or former President Trump has gone off into the distance quietly, right? That's just not his style. So
no,
good luck with that.
You're right about that. Yeah.
That's David Fahrenthold from The Washington Post. We speak to him every Tuesday morning. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.